Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Tale of Mr. Schumann's Opus. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, a look back at the life of one of the most powerful people in the arts in America during the 20th century, composer William Schumann. And later, Canadian jazz singer Holly Cole performs live in our studio. But first, it seems like everywhere you look in the arts world these days, there's talk of new leadership. President Obama is searching for a new head of the National Endowment for the Arts. More than 200,000 people have signed an online petition calling for the creation of a Secretary of the Arts in the Obama cabinet. And today, we're going to look back at composer William Schumann, who was a steadying hand in American arts administration for 25 years. We're joined by Joseph Polisi, who is president of the Juilliard School and author of the book American Muse, The Life and Times of William Schumann. Joseph, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Delighted to be back, John.
Now, he was a predecessor of yours in that he led the Juilliard School, William Schumann.
Yes, he was president from 45 to 61, and he was the fourth president. I'm the sixth president.
Yeah. And then went on to Lincoln Center during its formative years in the 60s. So why is it so important to kind of look back at William Schumann's experience in the 40s, 50s, and 60s at this time in the arts?
I believe very strongly that Bill set the foundation upon which all of the arts, the classic arts, and to some degree even the popular arts, are functioning today. And the sad thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that not enough people know about Bill, the administrator, and Schumann, the composer. So I'm hoping that my book will be an opportunity for people to see what this fascinating and energized man did during his lifetime.
Well, when you say that, you know, he kind of set the foundation, I mean, the structure that's been built on that foundation seems a little rickety right now. I mean, what was that foundation? What was he all about as an administrator?
Bill was totally and completely dedicated to education, first of all, not just professional education, but education so that individuals could appreciate the arts at whatever level possible. So he was a great advocate for the arts at the primary and secondary levels of schools around the nation. And of course, this is something we desperately need today, as we have always, but I think even more so than in the past. He was also, of course, a great educational innovator in the field of music, but not just in that side of it, but also brought in dance and drama to Juilliard in 1951 for dance and 68 for drama. And this set a tone and a model for the performing arts being together in one educational institution.
As he would do with film at Lincoln Center when he moved on to Lincoln Center.
That's exactly it. And when he went to Lincoln Center, he didn't see it as an assemblage of buildings where he was a real estate agent, but rather as an entrepreneur who would put these buildings to work, so to speak. So
let me stick with your analogy of the foundation for the moment. With education, with arts education often the first thing to disappear when there are budget cuts, sounds like those are pretty big cracks in that foundation. So
today.
Yeah, today.
Yes.
So again, the question is, I guess, what can we learn from the William Schumann story from the mid-20th century that we can apply to the problems facing us today?
I think the one thing that struck me, because I knew Bill quite well, but the thing that was amazing for me was his determination, his focus, and his ability to persuade others as to the importance of the arts in the fabric of American society. And he did that so effectively that he really created substantive change. And it was a multiplier effect.
What kind of changes did he create?
Well, first of all, he created, when he was president of Juilliard, something called the Literature and Materials of Music program, which was a different way of teaching music theory based on repertoire. And it had an impact in the 1950s and 1960s in educational institutions all around the United States. When he went to Lincoln Center, which really was the first art center of its type in the world, for that matter, and now is replicated all over the world, he was the one that said, we need a chamber music society, we need a film society, we need summer activities. There had never been summer concerts in New York City because of the lack of air conditioning in the earlier years, but still it had been thought that this was a time when nothing happened. And of course, we know now how vibrant a time it is. He also created the Lincoln Center Institute, which was a program that exists to this moment and is very vibrant, where aesthetic education was used within the schools. And that model has been replicated all over the world.
And wasn't William Schuman the one who got Juilliard sort of drawn into the orbit of Lincoln Center?
He lobbied tremendously for that. He believed that whatever the educational institution was at Lincoln Center was going to be one of the primary institutions of its type in the world. And he was right. Location, location, location. And he worked very hard with John D. Rockefeller III and the founders of Lincoln Center to make the Juilliard School be there.
We are speaking with Joseph Polizzi, who happens to be president of the Juilliard School and is author of the book called American Muse, The Life and Times of William Schuman. Schuman, an important composer, but as Joseph is telling us, a really pivotal figure in the development of the current arts situation. I mean, Lincoln Center, there would be no Kennedy Center, no Pompidou Center, as you say, it's been all around the world that kind of campus of
exactly.
The arts has been imitated. Now, he was a predecessor of yours, but he was also a mentor and a friend. How daunting a challenge is it for you to, sit in his old office and write this book about him?
That's a very important question, because I was very fearful that I would not be able to provide an objective view of Bill's life, because I did feel very close to him and respected him and very, very much. But what turned out to be the case was that Bill never threw away a scrap of paper, whether it was a major speech or a parking ticket. And all of those wonderful papers are collected at the New York Public Library at Lincoln Center in his collection. And then the archives of Lincoln Center itself, with all of its oral histories that are there, the New York Philharmonic Archives. So I had such a rich panoply of opportunities that I could always just quote Bill. If there was a negative experience that he was involved with, it was in his own words for the most part. So that's why I felt it was quite easy to do it finally.
So the result is this book, American Muse, The Life and Times of William Schuman. And you write that Schuman was, and I'll quote here, the first arts administrator who had to address the demands of the modern arts world. What was so different? What was the sea change that was going on there that he had to address?
What Schuman faced in the early 1960s, especially when he was at Lincoln Center, that's when it starts, is to have the highest level of artistic presentation and also to balance a budget. And before that time, it was really the impresario who, had to sell tickets, but it really was involved with bringing in artists, touring groups, and making everything work. But now he had this palette before him of the New York City Opera, the Metropolitan Opera, the New York Philharmonic, eventually the Chamber Music Society, the Film Society. And he kept coming up with new ideas. And Rockefeller said to him, enough already, stop. But Bill said, no, the most important element of Lincoln Center is the arts. Without the arts, why do we exist? We're just a combination of buildings. And actually, that was his downfall.
So the quote that we used at the very top of the show today, where he famously told all these arts organizations, it's not that your deficits are too big, they're too small. The meaning of that was what?
This is a speech he gave in 1966, and wonderfully, when we look back, there was actually a seminar, a symposium for about a day and a half in Princeton about the economics of the arts. And Rockefeller and others knew that Bill was the principal speaker, the keynote speaker. And Lincoln Center was going through a tremendously problematic financial time. They had to complete the construction of the building. Schedule was way off, and the budgets were way off. So what does Bill Schuman do with all of these dignitaries before him? He explains to them that we've got to lose more money. We've got to be more in the red. And, of course, this really was the beginning of the end for Bill, because Rockefeller, who was a patrician and who really didn't like to have arguments whatsoever, but he was forced eventually to ask Bill to resign.
Just because he was putting the arts before the bottom line, is it as simple as that? Or were there personality conflicts as well?
There were issues of personality. There were issues of who was in charge of what, the famous frictions that existed between the constituents caused a lot of bruises and some scars. But primarily, Bill felt deeply that he was anointed almost with the requirement that he create art for these buildings. And so in around 1967, he proposes to start a chamber music society. Rockefeller says, we don't have any more money for a chamber music society. Plus, the New York Philharmonic doesn't want it to be created because it'll probably compete for ticket sales. So do not do it. Bill goes ahead, meets with Alice Tully. He tries to bring Rockefeller along. Rockefeller comes along for a little while, but then eventually there are just too many deficits, and Bill has to resign. And in the short term prior to that, he suffers a heart attack and is really deeply affected. It's the least productive time in his life for compositions as well. So it's a very tough time for him.
Well, that was a balance that William Schumann had to strike throughout his professional life, was that balance between the composer and really this man who was quite possibly the single most influential arts administrator in America at the time. And in the 1980s, on a WNYC series called Meet the Composer, William Schumann spoke to WNYC's Tim Page about that.
Even if I had been wealthy enough not to have had to work for a living, which is far from the truth, I would still have wanted to take those positions. People always say, oh, how terrible, he had to do that. Quite the contrary. I could have remained on a college campus and had a much easier time of it, teaching a couple of days a week or something. No, I loved running the Juilliard School, and I enjoyed running Lincoln Center. And these were tremendous experiences for me. And those experiences enriched my life very, very much and made me a more interesting person to myself, perhaps not to others.
Now, Confucius said, may you live in interesting times, and didn't mean interesting in a very good way. Did people find William Schumann interesting in a Confucian sort of way?
I think people found Bill fascinating, frustrating, sometimes vain, and perhaps condescending, as well as brilliant, and certainly one of the great extemporaneous speakers of his time. But Bill did not suffer fools gladly. And he believed that he was the ultimate professional at Lincoln Center running the show. And he did not believe that the trustees had any artistic expertise whatsoever. And therefore, he should have the final say. And of course, that's not the way it works anymore. And it didn't work then either.
And yet, just to put, you know, at this point, a kind of obvious end to the story you were telling before. You know, he goes to meet Alice Tully. Rockefeller comes along but doesn't go along, in a manner of speaking.
Not entirely, right.
And yet, at the end of the day, there is an Alice Tully Hall and there is a Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. So, you know, there was a heart attack along the way and heartbreak, I'm sure. But, you know, in the end, he did get the vision that he saw.
Well, he was so determined and he was so correct. Also, I mean, that's the point. I mean, if we look, you know, in 2020 hindsight, everything he created, the Chamber Society, there was even a musical theater program that was started with Richard Rodgers that only lived for a few years from 1964 to about 1970. But mostly Mozart, Lincoln Center of Out of Doors, the Lincoln Center Institute, as I already said, all these are the, you know, the absolute legacy of a great and visionary individual. And they exist and they really succeed to this day.
We're speaking about the composer William Schumann with Joseph Polisi, author of the book American Muse, The Life and Times of William Schumann.
Check out today's Soundcheck blog.
Just a few months ago, we were celebrating Leonard Bernstein's 90th birthday, and people were asking, where will the next Bernstein come from? Now, as people debate the place of the arts in a struggling economy, the question becomes, where will the next William Schumann come from?
For the rest of the story, visit the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org.
Joseph, the cultural scene here is a very fragmented one, always has been, but even more so now. Is there any chance of a kind of figure, a kind of galvanizing magnetic figure on the cultural landscape along the lines of a William Schumann these days?
I think there is, especially with the Obama administration taking over the presidency in January. This is a time when there's a great deal of hope that many things will change in the United States. And if you could find a charismatic, galvanizing figure who wants to spend the time and who could be focused and who could have both the artistic wherewithal and expertise as well as the administrative expertise as Bill did, yes, it would come together. I mean, I think if Bill Schumann were in his prime today, I think the Obama administration would probably say, well, there's only one person to choose for a Secretary of Culture, if that's what we're going to create, hypothetically, and that would be Bill Shuman.
Hypothetically, are you in favor of a Secretary of Culture?
Complicated question. Complicated question in the United States, especially. America, from its colonial roots on to today, has many, many points of view about what the arts actually do. The commercial strength of the popular arts today has, of course, overrided what are so-called classical arts. There's so many heterogeneous characterizations of what we are as an American country that it's a hard road to hoe. On the other hand, I would feel wonderful if we could actually know that someone around that table, at the cabinet table, in the cabinet room, represents the arts. And that would be a wonderful thing if that could happen.
So if you got a phone call from the Obama administration, would you leave the Juilliard School to take that position?
An unlikely scenario, John. An unlikely scenario.
You didn't answer my question, though. All right, I'll let you slide on that one. Joseph Polizzi is my guest. He's president of the Juilliard School and author of the new book, American Muse, The Life and Times of William Shuman. And what do you think of the whole idea of arts administration, the Secretary of Culture or Secretary of the Arts? Where do you think the arts should be headed here in the States? You can leave a comment on the Soundcheck page of our website, WNYC.org. In the background, a little bit of William Shuman's music. Yes, he was a composer as well, and this one of his most famous pieces, the New England Triptych. Coming up in a moment, we'll hear more about William Shuman, the man, the baseball fan, and the composer of some 100-plus works. And then coming up later on Soundcheck today, Tom Waits' Jazz Style, courtesy of the Canadian singer Holly Cole and her band. They'll play live for us here in our Soundcheck studio.
Against a register with an apron and a spatula. Yesterday's deliveries, the tickets for the bachelors.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and we've been talking about William Shuman and his life as an arts administrator. He was president of the Juilliard School for more than 15 years, and in 1961 left to become the first president of Lincoln Center. But we don't want to ignore Shuman's life as a composer. Once again, my guest is Joseph Polizzi, who is currently president of the Juilliard School and author of American Muse, The Life and Times of William Shuman. Leonard Bernstein writes, I've rarely met a composer who is so faithfully mirrored in his music. The man is the music. What did Lenny mean by that?
Bill's music was often characterized as being muscular, so to speak. It had a big brass section, a lot of percussion, a lot of energy, a whole host of things like that. Exuberant, outgoing, and that was Bill. So that's, I think, what Lenny was talking about.
And also clearly rooted in the sounds of America, of popular song, of folk and jazz and things like that, which was that Bill Shuman as well?
Yes. Early on, before he started studying counterpoint and that sort of thing, he actually had a jazz band that was called Billy Shuman and the Alamo Society Orchestra. And when somebody asked him how they got the name, he said, well, Society Orchestra is a nice idea. And Alamo sounded exotic, although none of the players ever went south of Jersey City. So he was a lot of fun that way.
And the do you hear echoes of the Alamo Society Orchestra in some of the orchestral, the genuine orchestral music?
You know, that's a very interesting question. That was part of his life. In fact, he was a Tin Pan Alley songwriter with Frank Lesser, no less. But they were friends. But once in 1930, after this epiphany where he decides to be a so-called classical composer, he rejects it entirely. In fact, later in his life, he was not a great supporter of even jazz, serious jazz. So it's quite interesting that he saw a very definitive split in himself.
Huh.
Well, maybe music of his youth and then music of his adulthood. I don't know.
Did you ever have a chance to ask him why the change of heart?
Well, yes, I did. And most of the time it was that he saw pop music for sure, but even jazz to a great degree, as being music of a different type, not as organized, perhaps. Of course, he was wrong there, especially with jazz. But it was a prejudice that he had about jazz and about pop music that I think came from the fact that when he was writing pop music, he had no musical knowledge whatsoever. He was completely self-taught.
He was a violinist. He was a banjo player.
Yes, and a baritone.
Uh-huh. And as a young composer, wrote two symphonies that he later withdrew. So changing his mind about music that he had once upon a time felt strongly about seems to have been part of who he was. Why did he withdraw those first two symphonies?
Well, with the Second Symphony in particular, it was a public disaster of significant size. It was performed by no less an orchestra than the Boston Symphony Orchestra with Serge Koussevitzky. But it was a difficult and difficult work to be engaged by the audience. It really needed study, and he also came up with a few ideas that were very annoying. For example, for the audience, the repetition of the note C, do, perpetually, and it annoyed the audience so much that in fact it was broadcast on CBS radio. And one listener from Iowa said that he heard the symphony and he's had a headache for 3 days, even though he's been taking aspirin all the time. So that was a disaster, and he just simply withdrew it.
All right. And the first one, just the Follies of Youth?
Yes, he saw that as juvenilia. However, the Third Symphony, which is also premiered by Koussevitzky and the BSO, is an enormous success. And that happens in 1941. So when you really think about it, even with the Second Symphony, it's premiered in 1939, only 9 years after he starts studying music seriously.
And Koussevitzky and the Boston Symphony Orchestra give him a mulligan on that one and invite him back to write a third symphony.
As well as the American Festival Overture that happens before the Third Symphony.
Which is also a very, very hugely popular piece for William Schumann.
Exactly.
Here is a little bit of that Symphony No. 3 in a recording by the Seattle Symphony and Gerard Schwarz. A little bit of William Schumann's Third Symphony, the first one to be successful and the first one that he allowed to be sort of published and which he acknowledged as his own. A little bit of the first movement of the Third Symphony by William Schumann, whose life and times we are examining on Soundcheck today with Joseph Polisi, the president of Juilliard School and therefore one of William Schumann's successors in that position, and author of the book American Muse, The Life and Times of William Schumann. He, when he was at Juilliard, actually, he did many counterintuitive things. The famous Princeton speech, you know, your deficits aren't too big, they're too small.
At Lincoln Center, yeah.
But at the Juilliard School, he actually decreased enrollment. Why did he do that?
He wanted higher standards. And one has to remember that in 1945, when he took over as president, the World War II was over. The GIs are coming back. The GI Bill exists. And so there was this influx of it's very amusing to look at the enrollment in 46, for example, 47. There were 57 trumpet players, 80 saxophone players.
So all the guys from the military bands.
Yes, clarinets, hundreds of clarinets. So it was really an effort to try to bring Juilliard to a higher level, and that's, of course, what he did.
All right. And somehow along the way, he found the time to continue to write music. And in fact, one of his early successes was a piece for band, you know, for those self-same clarinets and saxes and trumpets. The piece we heard at the coming out of the break, the George Washington Bridge, which we have two comments on the website from people in, you know, who in different parts of the country grew up playing that piece, George Washington Bridge, still kind of a band favorite, I guess.
Bill loved bands. He felt there was a patriotic manifestation of everything musical. And so he loved to write for bands. In fact, he arranged orchestral pieces for bands. And his father, in fact, was a member of a band during the Spanish-American War. So this for him was Americana.
And he never changed his mind on that. I mean, the popular song, the jazz, you know, the big change of heart about liking it early on and then turning away from it. The band music he stayed with the whole time?
You know, that was also a characteristic of Bill in his later life as a mature composer. He saw his band music and he saw his choral music. One has to remember that he was one of the great choral composers of the 20th century in America as simpler music. His complex, serious music, as far as he was concerned, what he thought would represent his intellect best was his orchestral music and his string quartets. For example, I analyzed in my book, in the appendix, the fourth string quartet. And the listeners can actually go to the website of the book, which is www.schumann-americanmuse.com.
Or easier, just go to our website. We have a link there.
Very good.
And the soundcheck page at WNYC.org.
Great. And you could actually stream 10 pieces in full. And one includes the fourth quartet, which is extremely complex, almost unknown because it was only recorded once, and is a spectacular piece.
He was also, you write a fair amount about his love of baseball. Now, yes. Was that a lifelong love as well, or did he turn away from that at some point?
He loved baseball to the day he died and probably from the day he was born. In fact, the first chapter of the book is called The Fiddle and Baseball. He grew up in Manhattan in the Upper West Side, around 112th Street in Columbia. He claims to have seen Lou Gehrig hit the balls from 112th to 114th Street. He wrote an opera, The Mighty Casey, that was premiered in the 1950s.
I just want to make clear, when he's talking about seeing Lou Gehrig, he doesn't mean in Yankee Stadium.
No,
he means
Columbia.
Growing up in the neighborhood with Lou Gehrig.
Well, I think Gehrig went to Columbia University.
Columbia University,
early
right.
on. He didn't finish his degree, and so that's where he saw him, exactly. So he loved baseball. He saw baseball as a way of looking at American life and with discipline, with strategy, with determination and calmness, one could achieve a great deal. I mean, he wasn't the first, obviously, to see the baseball that way.
Well, that's a good place to leave it. We've been talking about a really remarkable, almost Renaissance figure, William Schumann, arts administrator, perhaps the most important arts administrator in America in the 20th century, but also a leading composer, lifelong baseball fan, and the predecessor of Joseph Polisi in the office of president at the Juilliard School. Joseph Polisi's book is called American Muse, The Life and Times of William Schumann. Great to see you again. Thanks so much for sharing the story with us.
John. Great pleasure.
Coming up in a moment, another artist with an unconventional and eclectic approach to music, singer Holly Cole, will perform some Tom Waits in a jazz setting. And tune in tomorrow for a preview of the role of music in Sunday's Super Bowl. This is Soundcheck.